We are back with On Second Thought from GPB. I'm Virginia Prescott. Georgia is home to hundreds of thousands of military veterans and boasts tens of thousands of active duty and reserve personnel. And with those numbers often comes four letters, PTSD. Well, later in the show, we're going to talk about a play about how the effects of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, play out in one couple. Symptoms range from nightmares to those as severe as suicidal thoughts. But first, we've got Dave Phillips still with us. He covers military and veterans affairs for the New York Times. Liza Zwieback is with us in the studio to help us understand more about PTSD. She is Associate Clinical Director at the Emory Healthcare Veterans Program. Hello, Liza.
Hi.
All right, Dave, I just want to, I know we have just a couple minutes with you, so I want to pick up on what we were talking about earlier. The Navy was sued last year over alleged discrimination against veterans with PTSD by the Naval Discharge Review Board. This board rejects nearly 85% of requests from upgraded benefits relating to PTSD. This is compared with 45% in the Army. So what came of this case?
You got me on that one. So there's been a real problem with these boards in looking at PTSD and approving it. And I think it underlies a bigger issue, is that the military and the VA have a real difficult time saying what is PTSD and what is not definitively.
Yeah,
and there are people, patients, who will downplay their symptoms, and there are people who will exaggerate their symptoms for various reasons. And so it leaves clinicians and the government, who I think probably want to do a decent job of defining this, kind of in the dark.
Liza's, she's nodding her head here. What do you want to say?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It is very hard, I think, to agree on what is a PTSD diagnosis, kind of from person to person. And I think it's very often the case, as being said, that there may be disagreement in whether a particular person has PTSD or does not.
We're going to pick up with Liza in just a minute, but Dave, before you go, I want to ask about your reporting you've done on some innovative treatments for PTSD. Last year, in fact, reporting on a new study that shows that the street drug ecstasy could be a promising treatment for PTSD. What's in that study?
First, let me just say, don't go out and try ecstasy and think that it's going to work.
But note and point taken.
For years, there has been interest in the idea of guided therapy, where oftentimes a patient will have trouble accessing the events, thinking about the events, understanding the events that are causing trauma. And so if you can flood their brain with chemicals that enable trust and well-being, which ecstasy does, then maybe you can allow them to see those facts and those emotions and try to process them. And so there have been experiments. They're now in, I believe, their phase three trials for FDA approval to look at, okay, if we have therapists guiding people through this process, can it help? And what the data shows is it helps a lot. And so you would take two, maybe three doses of this over several months, and that would be it. It's not like taking a pill every day. And through those therapy sessions would hopefully recognize and begin to process things as part of a larger psychotherapy regimen.
So in conjunction with therapy, the psychiatrist and the MacArthur Genius Grant winner, Jonathan Shea, he said that PTSD doesn't encompass all of the challenges active military and veterans face in their recovery from trauma. He calls it moral injury, and that is his real concern. Here he is.
If it gets bad enough, especially in moral injury, as I define it, betrayal of what's right by someone with legitimate authority in a high-stakes situation, then the character begins to change. One's social and moral horizon shrinks, sometimes just to oneself, or it shrinks to a tiny little circle. It might be just one squad.
Dave, how mainstream is this notion of moral injury?
I think a lot of veterans have heard about it, and a lot of civilians have not, you know, but the point is really important that we use in the civilian world PTSD as sort of a catch-all for the things that might affect someone during war. And I think that there's all sorts of things. PTSD is a small part of it. And so treatment is probably much broader than just talking about PTSD. How do you give someone who's come back from combat a meaningful life once they have, you know, maybe seen and done things that they can't abide by? And I think that's what Jonathan and Shay has thought a lot about, is we need to broaden how we think about this injury and how we're going to address it. And a lot of times that's a lot of stuff outside of the therapy office.
Dave Phillips, thank you so much for your time, and we'll be watching for your reporting on that case. Appreciate it.
Thanks for your time.
Dave Phillips, he's New York Times national correspondent covering military and veteran affairs. Lisa, so back to you. This idea of the moral injury, do you think that we do hear PTSD a lot and we hear about its symptoms? We know a lot more about the brain now, but is that idea of the moral injury, that it is something, we flatten things out when we say this is PTSD?
Yeah. So the term moral injury actually has been catching on quite a lot in recent years. And I think is very catchy for lots of reasons. I think it captures a dimension that, kind of as you're saying, the sort of flat kind of abbreviation PTSD maybe doesn't seem to capture in people's minds. However, you know, you don't always get complete agreement on what moral injury is either, right? And to me, moral injury, really, a lot of it amounts to guilt and shame over one's actions, right? In war. Also in, you know, in civilian cases where people experience trauma and develop PTSD, they will also have kind of what, you know, what some people might consider moral injury in terms of, you know, feeling guilt and shame over having done something, over having, you know, not done something. But as far as I'm concerned, that guilt and shame actually can be part of successful PTSD treatment. And so I'm a little bit less aligned with the idea that moral injury is something separate. I think moral injury, you know, as I think people are conceptualizing it, has always been part of not only PTSD, but kind of PTSD treatment.
Mm-hmm. So guilt and shame are part of the effects of PTSD?
Yes, they're actually symptoms of PTSD.
So how do you treat that?
That is a great question. Well, so, you know, I think particularly if we're talking about veterans, people who have acted in ways in the context of a, you know, of a war that don't necessarily comport with their own moral code, a lot of it comes down to contextualizing, right? And so this idea that we behave differently in a war zone mm-hmm. than we do in our normal lives. I'm oversimplifying it, of course, mm-hmm. but you know, I think as the course of treatment unfolds, we kind of see you know, our patients sort of unpacking and exploring their memories of what happened and kind of being able to incorporate more of the context of what was going on and what actually may have contributed mm-hmm. to their acting in the way that they did. And
as Jonathan Shay said, you have legitimate authority, a high-stakes situation. Somebody's telling you this is okay. In fact, this is what you have to do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
Well, what is going on? PTSD symptoms can include anxiety, nightmares, flashbacks. What triggers those mental and emotional reactions? What's happening inside of the brain?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, so so that we all respond as humans to threat in a particular way, which is to say that the amygdala in the brain is sort of the oversensitive alarm system, and it is designed to react kind of quickly, but not necessarily precisely.
Is that like the fight or flight?
Yes,
place?
Exactly. And but then we also have the prefrontal cortex, which acts more slowly but more accurately, right, and is able to kind of jump in and mediate and interpret what's going on. And you know, an example I would give is you're walking along and you see a stick on the ground, and for a second you say to yourself, it's a snake, and your body kind of reacts in a way that looks like a fear response. And then, you know, the kind of the prefrontal cortex part of your brain jumps in and says, no, it's a stick, it's fine, carry on. So that's the way that we are, you know, built to respond. The person with PTSD will have more activation in the amygdala. So studies have shown there's sort of more activation in the amygdala, the fight or flight piece, and less activation or underactivation of the prefrontal cortex. And so the world kind of seems more dangerous to the person with PTSD than it might actually be.
So they're seeing a lot more snakes, or that stick stays a snake a lot longer?
Oh, that's, I might say both, actually. I would say there's just kind of like an over-attunement to the presence of threat and danger in the world.
So you said that the body feels this. What are the effects on the body of PTSD?
There is, so I will say it's, you know, I myself am not an expert on the effects on the body. I'll just kind of talk a little bit basically about how the body is not meant to be constantly in fight or flight. You know, fight or flight is meant to be a real momentary kind of life-saving adaptive response. The person with PTSD spends more of their time in fight or flight than is optimal, right? And so a lot of stress hormones are flooding the body more than is ideal, and that tends to have, I'm just going to speak broadly, kind of long-lasting effects on the organs, on the heart, so on and so forth, on just kind of overall adaptive functioning.
So we talked a little bit about Jonathan Chase, the idea of the moral injury, and part of the things that he talks about is that what is one of the ways to counter that is the support from peers. Let's just hear a little bit of that.
Credentialed mental health professionals like me, in my view, have no place in center stage. It's the veterans themselves healing each other that belong in center stage. We're stagehands. Get the lights on, sweep out the gum wrappers, count the chairs, make sure it's a safe and warm enough place.
Now, I'm not treating him as a clinician, but I'm wondering about, is that something you abide by, this idea of creating a sense of comfort, a sense of warmth? How do you marry that kind of physical intimacy connection with the clinician's work?
Yeah, well, so one thing I will say, the program that I work in, Emory Healthcare Veterans Program, one of the things that I think we have found is that we are administering treatment in kind of a cohort. And so I'm working individually with one person, but that person's also going through treatment in a stepwise fashion alongside other vets who are also receiving treatment. And there are some groups that are part of our program. And I think there is a demonstrable effect of that support from their peers that they're getting that they wouldn't get, right? Just kind of coming to see a therapist once a week or something to that effect. So I'm not necessarily, I think, as on board with the idea that, you know, I'm a stagehand necessarily, but I think that both are important.
What would your role be in the whole production here?
You know, I think of myself in terms of the therapy that I do. I think I'm like a personal trainer. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm, you know, looking at my folks with PTSD who have kind of let their lives be very narrowed. You know, they've kind of isolated themselves. You know, they tend to avoid reminders. They tend to avoid crowds. They tend to avoid all of these things that for most of us kind of are part of a full life. And so a lot of what my role is to help them actually get back into that full life by approaching the things that they've been avoiding.
Liza Zwieback is with us. She's assistant associate clinical director at Emory Healthcare Veterans Program. So she's a lot of vets treating PTSD, first responders, military members. These are all people trained to be in these high stress environments. So what are some of the misconceptions we have about PTSD? It's a term we hear a lot.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think I heard you say before that there's a tendency to kind of lump everything into the category, the umbrella of PTSD, that if somebody has a trauma history, then boom, they have PTSD. And that is not so. In fact, most people actually have a trauma history. Unfortunately, most people don't have PTSD. And so actually resilience is the rule versus the exception. And so for a minority of folks who do experience something traumatic in their lifetime, they do go on to experience PTSD, but it is not as though just by virtue of having experienced something traumatic, a person develops any kind of psychiatric condition.
Mm-hmm. This is one of the interesting things to me. You just mentioned that, you know, a lot of people have trauma in their lives, and there's multi-generational trauma. You talked about how the brain operates in the amygdala with someone with PTSD, But I understand that that can actually be carried on, those traits, from generation to generation. What do we know about that?
Yeah, and I will say this, it's a little bit outside of my wheelhouse, but my understanding is that there's been a lot of really promising research with animal models that suggest this kind of intergenerational transmission of the effects of trauma, which is really interesting. I think there's been some more theoretical work over the years kind of suggesting those effects in humans with Holocaust survivors and their children and successive generations. But I think there's a lot more to be discovered there.
What is the most effective way to treat PTSD? Oh,
that's a great question. There are several very, very well-supported methods for treating PTSD. So within the kind of the category of psychotherapy alone, there are, I would say, three empirically supported treatments, evidence-based treatments. And the one that I do the most of is called prolonged exposure therapy. And this is premised on the idea that, as I kind of mentioned before, people with PTSD tend to avoid things a lot. Mm-hmm. They avoid things that remind them of a traumatic event, of their traumatic event, that is. They avoid things that feel unsafe, even though objectively they're not unsafe. They avoid thinking and talking about their traumatic event from the past. And so what this avoidance does, unfortunately, even though it kind of works in the short term, really effectively, it perpetuates the symptoms. It maintains them, never actually allows people to get back into their lives, as I was talking about before. And so prolonged exposure therapy really jumps off from that premise.
Okay. And then CBT, the cognitive behavioral therapy, do you work in that realm as well?
Yes. And prolonged exposure is sort of within that CBT umbrella.
Okay. And we mentioned, Governor Kemp, Brian Kemp, in April signed the HOPE Act into law. This allows limited regulated production of medical cannabis oil. Some researchers think this drug and others like ecstasy and MDMA could help with PTSD. What does your research say?
Yeah. So actually, the MDMA piece is something that looks really promising and something that my colleagues are starting to study. And I would definitely agree with the reporter who was speaking before about the way that this is going to work. It's not a long-term treatment. It's not, in other words, people are not on MDMA
forever,
for any kind of prolonged period. But that being on a dose of it one or two times kind of has this persistent effect. Cannabis and cannabis oil, I think it's a little less clear, kind of, from my understanding, what the mechanisms would be. One thing I will say, just with our patients, we actually prefer, and this gets a little controversial and a little difficult, we prefer that they not actually use cannabis because it gets in the way of learning these things that we need them to learn.
Liza Zwieback, thank you so much for speaking with us. I'm sorry you can't stick around to analyze the folks in the play that we're going to be speaking with in just a minute. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
She's Associate Clinical Director at Emory Healthcare Veterans Program.